Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI sends greetings and blessings to all the grandparents in the world. We hear of the terrible predicament of the people of Zimbabwe and of how it is getting harder and harder for them to keep the flame of hope alive. And film critic Peter Malone takes a look at a dramatic film that paints a picture of South Africa during the apartheid era. Pope Benedict XVI especially spoke of grandparents on Sunday, sending forth a special greeting and blessing to all the grandparents of the world. Speaking to those gathered to pray the Angelus in Lecum, where he is spending some time in rest, the Pope said that in the family it is the grandparents who are the depositaries and the witnesses of the fundamental values of life. Lydia O'Kane has this report.
There was great anticipation this Sunday for the Pope's Angelus in Lecum, as it was the village where the Holy Father has been spending his holidays. Hundreds of people from the Diocese of Aosta and from further afield gathered in a meadow given over for the occasion by the Salesian community to hear the Pope's words.
Thank you for joining me here in Lecum to pray the Angelus.
Surrounded by a sea of red flowers and protected from the rays of the sun, the Holy Father, during his Angelus address, invited everyone to pray for grandparents. Citing the grandparents of Jesus as an example, he said, "Grandmothers and fathers bore witness to fundamental values and had an important role to play in the formation and education of young people, especially in today's world."
In particolare ci invita a pregare per i nonni.
Before reciting the Marian prayer, the Pope referred to a passage in St. John's Gospel which recounts the miracle of the loaves and the fishes. "In this year of the priest," said the Pope, "we reflect on this text of a boy who has 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And he explained that when priests trust in the Lord, just like in the Gospel story, they can become instruments of salvation for all." This was the Pope's last Sunday in the Aosta region before he travels to Castel Gandolfo on July the 29th, and he took this opportunity to thank the people of the area for their goodwill and discretion during his stay. Pope Benedict then urged people not to forget God during their holidays, because, he said, "the Lord remains at our side and accompanies us on our way." I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for that report. I've been wanting to do a descriptive programme of the tragic humanitarian situation in Zimbabwe for a long, long time. But it's difficult. In the past months, I've put together programmes about the political situation there, about the HIV pandemic, about the plight of the elderly and the AIDS orphans, about the lack of medical and educational infrastructures, about the rampant human rights abuses and the indifference of the rest of the world. But I feel I've never managed to convey my deep feelings and thoughts about that beautiful country and its resilient people. I've never managed to put all the dramatic issues they face together on one canvas and paint a satisfying landscape or portrait of the tragic reality of a resourceful country that used to be known as the breadbasket of southern Africa, and today is a hellhole for its inhabitants who are dying in huge numbers of HIV/AIDS, cholera and malnutrition, or are seeking refuge or asylum in countries where unemployment is not rife and human rights more or less respected. And then recently, I met a man who had much to say about Zimbabwe because of what he does. I found him particularly inspiring and asked him to speak to me about his work there, about his thoughts on the situation, and about his own hopes for the people. First of all, I said to him, please introduce yourself.
Garvin Augustine, I am from Kingston, Jamaica. I belong to an association called Mustard Seed Communities. We look after children with disabilities and the children who are infected or affected by HIV/AIDS. We started 32 years ago in Kingston, Jamaica, and we've expanded to Nicaragua, to the Dominican Republic. We started a project in Haiti, but we had to temporarily shut it down a couple of years ago, but we are reopening it this year. And in 2001, we went into Zimbabwe, where we have a mission there, looking after children, caring for AIDS orphans, running schools, and so on.
I meet you here in the Beda College. Are you studying to be a priest, I assume?
Yes, yes. You're correct. I started here in 2007 for 4 years to become a priest. I can't say that I've always felt this way. When I joined Mustard Seed in 1996, I just wanted to be a volunteer, doing social work, you know. But I lived in community. It's a lay association, so there are a few of us who live in community with the founder, who is Father Gregory Ramkisoon. And over the years, I just felt that I had a vocation to the priesthood, I had a calling, and I wanted to commit myself more fully to this life. So I started here at the Beta 2 years ago, and I have 2 more years to do. But in the off periods when I'm not studying, I go back to my mission work in Zimbabwe and in Jamaica.
I was going to ask you, have you actually been to your mission in Zimbabwe? Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Well, first I'll go back a little further. When we were invited to Zimbabwe by the then Archbishop of Bulawayo, Pius Mubi, he wanted us to come there and assist with the HIV pandemic. With a lot of resistance, I went. I must say that I did not really want to go.
Why not?
Because of all the things that you hear about Zimbabwe in the media and so on. You know, life seemed very difficult. And indeed it was, and is, still is. But I went there and I found that there was probably an even greater crisis in 2001, and that is people were hungry. So apart from the scourge of AIDS, you have a situation where thousands of people were just starving. Nothing in the shops, the agricultural sector had collapsed, people didn't have jobs, people didn't have money to buy anything, and people were just going hungry. So we made a decision there and then to focus on feeding people rather than tackling the AIDS crisis, which would have been another hurdle trying to get the AIDS drugs in, which still is a problem up to today. So we used our resources to start what we call nutrition programs, feeding children on a daily basis, and that has continued up to today. Right now, we feed on average 700 children each day, and it's the only meal they get. And we have 4 feeding centers where we feed these children, and you have hundreds of children coming, and inevitably the food runs out. And they're so orderly, and they're so disciplined, and they come with their little dishes, their little bowls, and when the food is finished, those who don't get just turn away and go back. And
heartbreaking.
It is. And we have tried very hard to increase, but because of several factors in the country, we have to do things very quietly and very simply, not attracting too much attention and so on.
As is everyone I have ever spoken to about Zimbabwe, whether inside the country or out, Garvin is careful not to spell out situations that could in any way create problems for people living there. But it is no secret that not all of the aid money meant for humanitarian projects in Zimbabwe reaches its rightful destination.
Where do you get the food? Where do you get the money?
Well, like all NGOs, we have resources and funding externally. From the United States and from England, we have donors who give us money, and we buy things and import. So the only people who can really bring food into the country are the wealthy people who have the money, or the non-profit organizations, charitable organizations that can bring food from South Africa or Botswana and so on.
There's no possibility of buying food that's produced in Zimbabwe?
Well, there's nothing being produced right now, and for a while now. But I must say that this, over the last 6-8 months, it has changed a bit in that there's now food in the stores in Zimbabwe. So you can buy things, imported goods, there locally.
That's if you've got US dollars or South African rand.
Precisely. You have to have the US dollar, the pound, or the rand. And again, people don't have that. You know, you have an unemployment situation of 80-85%. I mean, so it's people just cannot afford. So we do the best we can. Apart from the feeding program, we also started 3 schools, nursery schools, kindergartens, where we have right now about 200 children attending class every day for half the day. And they also get a meal with as coming. So again, that they get their nutrition. And that, I must say, we've worked closely with the Ministry of Education there to get our schools approved, and they have approved it, and we are working with them in educating these children, preparing them for primary level education.
Are these mostly children who come from the rural areas, or are they based in Bulawayo, which is quite a big city, isn't it?
Yes, well, we are based just on the outskirts of Bulawayo, our main mission, and we get children from all parts, from the rural parts, coming walking for miles to come to school. We built a church there as well, so we have people coming from all areas, all parts around, surrounding areas, for miles walking to come to church on a Sunday. And the other centers also are sort of in high density areas, what we call low income, very densely populated areas.
Slums.
Yes. So we focus all our efforts right now in Bulawayo. There aren't many other NGOs operating for varied reasons. It is difficult to move things, equipment, medical supplies, and that's another big challenge. I mean, then the professionals have left for one reason or another. So you have a shortage of doctors, a shortage of nurses, teachers, no medical supplies. We really hope, I mean, we try to keep hope alive in offering what we offer, and hopefully eventually people will begin to come back home and meet the needs of the people there.
These words immediately brought to my mind something I'd recently seen on the news. Zimbabwean Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai on a journey to Europe and to the United States to garner support and funding for his nation's Young Unity government, appealed to Zimbabwean expats to return home and help rebuild their country.
Let me state here, and I'll state it boldly, that Zimbabweans must come home.
As you can hear, his address was repeatedly interrupted by jeering and chanting by the crowd, demanding that first President Robert Mugabe must step down. You've been to Zimbabwe often in these past years. The situation has been getting worse and worse and worse, and there was an election and there was hopes that things might change a little bit. Maybe they are slightly, very slightly. You've been speaking to the people there. What are their hopes? How do they feel about their future?
It's difficult to keep the fire of hope alive. People don't seem to have much hope. They don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. The impression I get is that people are still crossing the border in spite of the changes in the last few months. I think that has yet to be translated into real, tangible differences on the ground. I mean, yes, as I said, there's food in the shops now, but people can't buy it. I mean, that's the only thing you can say that has changed. But the professionals still haven't come back. I mean, we haven't seen anything. The medical services are still the same way. So it's difficult to keep hope alive. People don't see a promising future as yet. And until things really start changing, I don't know. I don't know that people will feel good about their country. I mean, it's a beautiful country. I don't think it will take much to turn it back around. A lot of infrastructure that was there 10, 15 years ago is still there, but crumbling slowly. So if things change in the next 6-8 months, I think the country can turn around quickly in a couple of years.
And how important is it, I asked Garvin, to keep the story of the Zimbabwean people in the news? Since the election a few months ago, it has rapidly disappeared from the headlines.
I think it's important. In any crisis situation, it's important to keep people, keep the message out there that people are hungry, that people are dying. In this day and age, people are still dying of AIDS. I mean, why? When in the West, that is unheard of. Why are people dying of AIDS in Africa? Why are people hungry in Africa when in the West, you know, we waste so much? And so I think it's important to keep those stories in the news, whether it's Zimbabwe, whether it's Uganda, whether it's Somalia. I mean, it's important to keep these stories where people are sensitized, where people are informed, in spite of whatever, in spite of differences, in spite of political differences. I think we have a responsibility to care for the other. We can't allow political or ideological differences to prevent us caring for our brother and sister.
It must be quite heartbreaking to work with children, especially. Is it something you do personally? Do you have any special memory of any particular child or situation?
Well, there's one child. Yes, I love children. I mean, I have so many children. There's one child in Zimbabwe. I remember this old man came. This is about 6 years ago, just when we started. And he brought this baby, who I thought was about 1 year old at the time, a little baby, and asked if we could look after this child. He walked for about 30 miles with this child and said the child's parents are dead and his wife, which is the child's grandmother, also passed away and he couldn't look after the child. And we took the child, and he was actually 3 years old, but he was so malnourished that he looked like he was 1 year. And we fed him, and we cleaned him, and we medicated him, and now he is bright. And in fact, funny enough, his name is Bright. And he's a very bright young lad. He's still with us. We never saw the man again. We don't know where he disappeared to. But Bright thinks of me as his father. And now he's about, 8 years old, and he's doing well in school. We got him, he went through our own preschool, and then now he's in primary school, and we're looking after him. That's just one of many stories in Zimbabwe and in Jamaica. I mean, similar.
So we hope for a bright future.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, we hope for a bright future for Bright. And
absolutely,
those children, actually, we tell them that we hope that they will be the future of Zimbabwe.
Well, I find it really difficult to get my mind and my emotions round some of the statistics I read. But I know that Bright's story is the story of so many children in Zimbabwe, where, according to figures released in 2007, one in every four children is an orphan. Notwithstanding the sadness, notwithstanding the dramaticity of his tale, Garvin appears really happy and grateful to be part of life in Zimbabwe.
They're lovely people, and yes, they name their children after, you know, things that happen, or, you know, sunshine, that sort of thing. But they are wonderful, wonderful, loving, caring people. I remember, again, just a little story. I remember when I first went there. Coming from the West, I mean, you're sort of, this culture is so different. Somebody died in the area, and I didn't go to the house. And the people were so angry with me. And I couldn't understand why. And they said, culturally, once someone dies within a certain radius of where you are expected to attend the funeral, you're expected to come and mourn with the family, which is so different to the West. I mean, you sometimes you don't even know who your neighbor is. And if the person dies, you don't go. But even if you don't know the person, you go and you show your face and you mourn with them, you grieve with them, you attend the funeral. And that's the kind of caring. I suppose that's why they've survived for so long, because caring is second nature to them. And I've learned so much from that you know, nobody is a stranger. Everyone is your brother and your sister and your father and your mother. And there's a little old lady, she's about 90 years old, and every time I go back for Christmas or for the summer, in the last 2 years since I've been here in Rome, she just runs up to me and she says, "Oh, my son, little old lady who's as poor as ever." And she would bring something that from her garden for me. She can't afford, but yet she would still give, and she treats me like a son. I mean, that's the kind of that we have so much to learn that we can learn from that sort of culture. Beautiful people.
Now it's over to my friend, film critic Peter Malone, who heads the film office at CYGNUS, the World Catholic Association for Communication. Today we stay in the area, geographically that is, as he tells us about a dramatic film from South Africa. It's called Skin.
I saw it in Washington, D.C. during a film festival. I hadn't actually heard of the film at all. It's getting a release in the U.K., but very limited at the Institute of Contemporary Arts, which I think's a great pity because it's one of the more interesting films about a country you know something about,
yes,
South Africa.
Yes, exactly. I must tell you, it wasn't easy to find it on the internet. So it obviously isn't very publicised. It doesn't have a wide distribution. But I managed to watch the trailer and I was very moved by what I saw.
I was wondering whether you knew anything of the background of the story.
Do you tell us what the story's about?
Well, I was going to, and then I thought, oh dear, I've forgotten the name of the young woman herself.
The young woman, Sandra Lang.
Sandra, that's right.
Yes.
She was born, I think, in the 60s or earlier.
In the 1950s, to a couple of white Afrikaners.
And she is quite black. She's played when she's an adult by Sophie Oikinado, who's on the stage in England quite a deal and appeared in Hotel Rwanda, for instance.
Right.
Her parents, by the way, are played by Alice Krieger, who's an actress originally from South Africa,
mm-hmm.
and by Sam Neill from New Zealand via Australia.
They have very convincing Afrikaans accents.
I have never been unfaithful to my husband. If there is black blood in our veins, we never knew about it.
I'm telling you, she's white. I'm her father.
They're actually very convincing in the film, which I'd have to tell you is a very sad film and about some of the dire consequences of apartheid. Basically, young Sandra, they want to send her to a school where her white-looking brother has been a student, and you can see in the 60s how strange this looks and the reaction of the teachers, of the girls, of the parents.
Sandra does not belong here. Sandra is a disruption.
Why are they all staring?
Yes, I said she looks completely black.
She looks completely black.
But her parents are white.
Mm-hmm.
And this raises a dilemma all throughout the story that how do you classify her and what are the criteria that were used in South Africa at the time for classifying people according to race? And her father, who's a very strong-minded Afrikaner type, is very insistent that she's white. At one stage then, a doctor suggests that way back some of the ancestry could be black and he won't hear a thing about that.
There's a plausible genetic explanation for Sandra's appearance.
Two white-looking parents can produce a child that's quite a lot darker than themselves. This phenomenon is commonly known as a throwback.
So she's classified, she's reclassified, she's not allowed in the school, she has to go home. And then, as she grows up, she's attracted by a young man in the village.
Pietras is a black man. He understands them all.
And she goes off with him, and the father cuts her off.
If you don't come now, you will never see your family again, I promise you.
So the latter part of the film is her struggle, and the young man is a bit of a rotter and abandons her. She has children. And so during the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, she has a very hard life, and her mother would like to contact her but is so dominated by the outlook of the father. So that emotional tension is very, very strong.
She's your daughter.
She made that choice.
Please, Mama, I need to see you.
But there was a postscript to say that she's alive and well, and
so it's also based on a true story, right?
Yes.
It's a ferocious photograph, ferocious but very truthful photograph of South Africa during the apartheid era. It shows what situations the non-whites, as they used to call them, had to live with, the humiliation of being a non-white in a white-minded society. And it also has a lot of film footage in, well, this is probably reconstructed sets, but in what were the camps that the non-whites lived in.
Yes, especially in the scenes in the 1980s,
right,
before,
right,
the end of apartheid.
With the bulldozers, yes, coming in. And
that's right, yes, yeah, pulling them down.
Very, very powerful.
I remember hearing some years ago from our superior general of our congregation, and he'd visited South Africa, and it had never occurred to me, but he pointed out that black South Africans could never go to midnight mass for Christmas because of the curfew.
Absolutely.
It was just one of those things that had never occurred to me and brought home the reality.
Do you know, black South Africans couldn't even cross town if they didn't have the authorization of their employers, who could be a little boy of 11 who just had to sign an authorization for a 50 or 60-year-old man who wanted to go home for the day.
Yes, it's certainly
was that humiliating.
Mm-hmm. Yes, human dignity doesn't enter in.
But yes, let's recommend this film, shall we, Peter?
Yes, if it comes around, and I hope it would get wider distribution than seems to be the case at the moment.
You can't help what you are born with, but you can help what you become.
That was Peter Malone, head of the film office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.